Hello, welcome to the Patient Activation Network podcast. I'm your host, Matt Cavallo. I'm sitting here with Doreen Birdsell, live at the 2017 Plaintree International Conference on Patient-Centered Care. So Doreen's going to share a little bit about her personal story here with us. So give it up for Doreen.
All right. Thank you very much, Matt. And thank you all, you know, for being here today. All of us have memories, hopefully. Some of them are really very colorful, and they are ignited by something that we see or hear, or perhaps it's a fragrance or an odor that triggers. Some memories we'll never forget. Some memories we only hope and wish that we could. My very first memory in life was when I was 3 years old. I was sitting on my Nana's lap in our big kitchen, yellowed walls, like a farmhouse, and she was dunking her golden butter toast in her tea while three-year-old me sat on her lap intent on when I was gonna get the next bite. And my father and my five-year-old sister, who was 2 years older, my four aunts and uncles were all in this big kitchen. And it felt like a festive occasion because the whole family was gathered together, and there I was on my Nana's lap. Then suddenly, they began to argue, and so much so that it distracted me from where I sat in that quiet little corner. And I heard my father yell the loudest, and everybody got quiet. And he said, "I can't take them anymore. I can't afford them, and neither can you. I'm going to give them to the Catholic Charities." What were the Catholic Charities, I wondered, but I knew that he was talking about my sister Donna and me. And in that moment, one of my uncles came over, and he scooped me off my Nana's lap, and he took me out into the backyard, far away from the sound of those escalated voices. There were fireflies and twinkling stars in the sky. I could hear the crickets, and there was my other uncle's garage that was like a barn up on the hill where we had all kinds of electronic gadgets, and I was excited to know that we were headed that way to explore. But instead, he stopped, and he laid me on the grass, and he did things to me that he told me were God's ways. And he said that this was a secret, that this was something that was only between him and me and God, and it was sacred. And he named his penis Saint Peter, this appendage I was, of course, completely unfamiliar with. When we got back into the house, the scene had completely changed. Everyone was leaving. They were getting their coats. And then I saw my father starting to walk out the door with my sister Donna holding his hand. And I screamed, "Daddy, Daddy, wait, wait. Take me, where are you going?" And instead, my two aunts blocked me, and they picked me up, and they laid me on my Nana's bed, and they smothered me between them in their bosoms while I cried convulsively. No one believed me when I told them the story. My sister and I had been separated, her to live with another aunt and that same uncle, and I lived with another aunt and uncle, and we lived 50 miles apart. On weekends, they would all get together to visit, and I would see my sister Donna, and that uncle would always volunteer to babysit. I would come home, and my aunt Hazel, who took care of me, would change my clothes, and she'd say, "How did your panties get on backward?" And I'd tell her very innocently and truthfully, "Well, Uncle Frank must have done it." And she would say, how can you kids say such things? That can't be true. And I would tell her what he did. And she would tell me not to say such things. And my sister, when she would overhear me, would report back to say that I told. And I was reminded again of this sacred secret that had to be kept holy and silent. Fast forward a few years, I'm in Catholic school, I'm in second grade. I had a ballpoint pen where the middle clip, you know, that you attach to your pocket had broken off, and it created a very sharp edge. I used it to carve a picture of a penis in my school desk. And at the same time, I had written a note to my friend across the aisle. I sat in the last row in the first seat. I wanted to know if Patricia Farisi had seen private parts like I had, because there were others after my uncle. Sister Catherine Timothy didn't miss a thing. She saw that note go across the aisle, and she started tearing down that aisle with that habit rustling and those beads swinging back and forth. She grabbed that note out of my hand. She read it. She raised her arm to give me a wallop, and she looked down at my desk, and she was shocked. And she shrieked, "What is that?" I was so afraid. Pleadingly, I looked up, and I said, "It's a lighthouse." She said, "A lighthouse?" I said, "Yes, and those are rocks with grass growing out." And then she asked, "Well, what is coming out of the top of the lighthouse?" I was sunk. I said, "Water?" That was the end of it. She tore off my clip-on school tie, which she said I didn't deserve to wear, and she marched me down to Sister Superior's office. Sister Superior was kind. She was loving, and she heard my story, and she believed me. They called my aunt up to school, and what seemed like only moments later, she sat across from me in this palatial Sister Superior office, and I noticed that she'd put on her Sunday coat, that she had taken time to put on lipstick, and she said to Sister Superior, "I never believed them. You know how these kids are." We never saw that uncle again. And my sister Donna, the day of that confrontation with my father and the other aunts and uncles about what he had done to us, they were more worried about what the neighbors might think or if it got into the local newspaper, not about what these two little girls thought or what these two little girls felt. My sister Donna started to have a convulsion. She was shaking violently. Later in life, she had been admitted to a psych ward. She was first diagnosed as schizophrenic. And being in and out of psych wards most of her life, she was finally correctly diagnosed as manic depressive bipolar. For me, the abuse didn't stop. I went on to be another family member, a camp counselor, a stranger in a car who exposed himself to me indecently. And I believe that children that have been sexually abused become like a magnet to pedophiles because our sexuality is opened up at a very young age. And I was so confused and still felt so unheard in my life. We lived in Queens, New York, and one afternoon I was standing on the corner, and these two nice ladies walked up to me and they said, "Are you lost?" I said, "No, I live down the block with my aunt and uncle. They take care of me because my mother died when I was two." And she said, "Do they take good care of you?" I said, "No, they don't feed me." I lied. I believe I lied because my soul was starving, not my body, starving to be heard and starving for attention. They took me upstairs to their apartment and they fed me soup. And they watched as I sipped the soup, spoon after spoon. Now you are all in healthcare. I know that you can understand the devastation and the damage that can happen when wounds of that nature are held inside. It isn't just emotional or psychological, but it can also penetrate us in ways that can later in life become physical. I used anything to check out. The first thing that I could find was my father's bottle of Southern Comfort on his dresser that I drank. After that, it became cleaning solvents, airplane glue. I smoked pot as I got a little older, hanging out with my friends that were using. Of course, I didn't pick the academics to hang out with, but I chose those that were living under the radar, getting high and wanting to check out as much as I did. I used so much LSD that I thought I'd never come back from the edge, and a friend of mine gave me heroin. And when I put that heroin into my veins, for the first time in my life, the first time in my entire life, I felt relief. I felt normal. I felt the streetlight that was glaring in a star, the glare of this of that light be sucked right into the globe as the heroin came into my veins. And that was my normal. I became addicted. I became so addicted that one cold, gray autumn afternoon, I was holding my bag of heroin normal, walking down the street, and there was no one around, and I didn't have works, which is another name for a hypodermic homemade eyedropper needle. And I saw this guy I knew, Richie Swindash, walking down the street, hunched over, eyes half open. I knew he was high. I said, "Richie, you got any works?" He said, "Yeah, man, but I got hep, which is short for hepatitis." And I said, "I don't care. I won't get it." And that afternoon, I mainlined a load of heroin and a load of hepatitis. 3 months later, I was in a hospital with hepatitis. And as soon as I got out, I ran to the dealer. They told me the only cure would be bed rest. And the first thing I did when my aunt and uncle went out to get the special needs food I would need was run to the dealer and get home in time so they wouldn't know I was out. 3 months after that, I relapsed. And it was now summer, and I was turning yellow. I was jaundiced. So I went to the beach to cover up the yellow. Addicts will do anything not to be found out. Thankfully and gratefully, I had a suspension of addiction when I temporarily went into a therapeutic community for a year after I had almost fatally overdosed. I was on the railroad tracks, and I was unconscious and frothing from the mouth, so I was told by this young boy, Jackie, that found me and wouldn't leave me alone. And he said, "If you don't keep walking, you're going to die if I leave you." I wanted to get rid of him so fast. And my cousin lived across the street. He asked me the date. I said, "Oh, September 8th, and I knew it was her birthday. And he took me to her house. I knocked on her door, and I fell full throttle, full on, onto her living room floor in her birthday party. And the next day, I was taken to Odyssey House. More years went by. I graduated to methadone, so I had at least managed my addiction with another substance. And then I graduated a little further to where I put down the methadone and withdrew from that, which was worse than a heroin addiction, and became a full-fledged alcoholic. I lived across the street from this person who became my friend, Shelley, across the hall. And she heard my drunken antics, and I lived in Chelsea, in Manhattan. And one day, she knocked on the door in the morning. I don't know what I had done the night before, but she did. I opened the door. She put her finger in my face, and she said, "Doreen, you're an alcoholic." That was the best gift that anyone up to that moment had given to me, because I felt as though someone told me what was wrong with me. At least I could stop doing the thing that was killing me to get to the stuff that was really killing me. I met a photographer and found my calling. I wound up opening up my own photo studio in New York. I happened to be very good at what I did, and he taught me very well. There were times that I would drink, and my photo session would be half out of focus. So what did I do? What would you do? I went to an eye doctor. I had 20/10 vision, but the eye doctor fit me for contacts because I had been drinking on my way to the appointments and couldn't see straight. So when I put them on, I really couldn't see straight. I was a mess, and anyone that wasn't a mess knew it. I later got recovery in 12-step, and I also found out about a program that the Karen Horney Clinic in Manhattan was giving, run by two therapists for women who'd been sexually abused. This finally became a place for me to tell my story, to be told that I wasn't to blame, and to release the shame. I was on a road to healing. I was 3 years sober, clean, dry. My first AA meeting, the woman talked about her sexual abuse. I heard my story. I was becoming successful as a photographer in New York City. I knew my life was just one straight line going up. And then my sister Donna called me one day, as she always did. But this time she said, Renee, it's my family nickname, Renee, Candace, her daughter, was molested. She was abused just like us. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it because every memory that I had came flooding back, and it felt like it was me. I was so angry because the anger of that kind of abuse is so huge. I would walk down streets and car alarms would go off. Street lights would pop. And I knew that I needed to deal with this and give this my full attention if I was going to heal. And I did. I healed to the extent where one day a friend of mine asked me if I had ever thought of writing a book. And I said no, but she planted the seed and she kept bothering me about it. And I wrote a memoir entitled Without Faith. Faith was my mother's name, who died when I was 2. And that memoir chronicles the story, part of the story that I shared with you here. I shared that memoir with the Children's Cove in Cape Cod, the Child Advocacy Center. Stacey Gallagher is the executive director. And when she read the book, she asked me if I wanted to become a member of their board. Today, I tell my story to help heal others, to enlighten people that the truth does set us free, that we can heal. And when I was driving down the street one day, I saw all these pinwheels in front of a bank. Have you heard of the Pinwheel for Prevention program? Every April, in most cities nationwide, they have these pinwheels that represent children that have been sexually abused. And this lawn was filled with over 200 pinwheels representing the 200 children who reported sexual abuse on Cape Cod and the islands. I thought, over 200. How many have not been heard? How many don't tell their story? These are the people I tell my story for. I was so inspired by those pinwheels that I went home that night and I wrote a poem, and I wrote, what of those who cannot speak, engulfed by fear, ensnared by shame, thinking that they were the blame? We know the truth will set us free. It can alter our future society. How could we turn away like we're blind? These children are yours. These children are mine. We are not superheroes. Sometimes, maybe some days we are, when our eyes are open and we're not afraid to turn away. What we do need to be in our superhero selves is super aware, because I believe many more can be saved and much can be prevented and so much can be healed. The most important thing that I got from my recovery, beside helping others, is I got to reconcile a faith with God that is unshakable, that I know that there is a God that loves me, that loves you, and uses everything for good purpose, no matter how tragic or how evil it might sound or be. The truth is in my hands, the truth is in yours, and I thank you for listening to mine.
Well, thank you, Doreen, and we all appreciate and respect your courage, and we're just so happy to have you here today. Before we let you go, though, where can our listeners here and at home find this book?
Withoutfaith.com. It's without faith, F-A-I-T-H.com. It's no coincidence. My mother's name was Faith.
So for those listening here and at home that want to pick up Without Faith, you could go to withoutfaith.com. She's Doreen Birdsell. I'm Matt Cavallo, host of the Patient Activation Network podcast. Thank you so much for listening in. We'll bring you another inspirational story soon.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Oh, we love you. Thank you.
Oh, God bless you.